Okay, we're ready to finish off tuberculosis. Hey, the costumes keep coming out by pathology. It's going to be fantastic, okay? Braun won't be able to lecture. He'll be distracted. We have two drugs yet to look at. Judas, I can't talk. I've been snacking upstairs. Two drugs yet to look at for the treatment of tuberculosis. And the next one we're going to visit is a drug called pyrazinamide. This, for many years, was a second tier or a second line drug for the treatment of tuberculosis, and was sort of reevaluated and shown that it was very effective. We'll see it also has some toxicity, but when it was used in short-term treatment, it was very effective in reducing the number of mycobacteria in a given population. And so it has been resurrected, or if you like, graduated from a second-tier drug to a first-tier drug with some qualifications, and we'll see in a second. This is the structure, and you can see where it sort of came from. This is the structure of pyrazinamide. And this is a drug that works by, again, a completely different mechanism, and this is at least one mechanism by which it works. The parent drug is inactive. It's a prodrug. So for pyrazinamide to be effective against Mycobacterium tuberculosis, period, because that's all it's effective against, it has to be hydrolyzed right here to pyrazinoic acid. The enzyme that carries out this hydrolysis of this amide is called an amidase, and it is a Mycobacterium tuberculosis encoded enzyme. It's encoded in a gene giving rise, a mycobacterial tuberculosis gene, giving rise to the amidase that then takes the prodrug or the inactive to the active pyrazinoic acid. PNCA is the gene, okay? It is the gene, the product of which is the amidase. The active drug, the pyrazinoic acid, is thought to work by decreasing, this is now a weak acid, decreasing the ambient pH to a level that impairs Mycobacterium replication. Resistance involves altered amidase enzyme. The pharmacology is again summarized here. Pyrazinamide, completely absorbed when taken orally, distributes throughout the body, again, able to achieve concentrations intracellularly, also concentrations in tissues, lungs specifically, also gets into the central nervous system, a potential sanctuary for Mycobacterium tuberculosis. And most of the drug is metabolized by hydroxylation and conjugation. Now, when this drug is used, there are a number of side effects associated with it. Now, you got to think of this as this plus other side effects associated with multiple drugs over long periods of time really have significant effects on compliance. It causes nausea, it causes hepatitis, it causes changes in liver enzyme levels. These changes are reversible if you stop the drug. The changes can become more persistent, increase to the point that the drug has to be terminated. The hepatotoxicity associated with pyrazinamide is going to limit its use clinically to about 2 months' duration. And so when pyrazinamide is used in protocols, it is typically incorporated in the protocol in the initial 2 month period. One cannot give this drug for longer periods of time without significant hepatic injury. The other is it has the potential to elevate uric acid levels. Hyperuricemia, there are elevated uric acid levels that can lead to gout or a non-gouty type of arthritis in a patient. This again is a reversible effect. But it is the hepatotoxicity that limits the duration of use, and therefore it is not at all uncommon to have baseline liver enzyme levels measured. The final drug that we're going to talk about is a substance called ethambutol. Again, another drug, and all of these compounds were identified through screening processes. There's some of them strange organic molecules, and this is certainly would fall into that category. Here's ethambutol, and I want you to note that this is an alcohol. It's a symmetrically designed molecule, alcohol, an alcohol here, and this is going to be one of the sites of metabolism. It is only effective against Mycobacterium tuberculosis, and it works by a different mechanism. I've given you half a loaf. That is, the cell wall is made up of mycolic acids. The mycolic acids are attached to unique polysaccharide found in the mycobacterial cell wall. And this unique polysaccharide is called arabinogalactan. And this polysaccharide is synthesized. So you have mycolic acid synthesis going on to make the cell wall. You have polysaccharide synthesis or arabinogalactan. Ethambutol inhibits an enzyme involved in transferring an arabinacyl group to the arabinogalactan structure of the polysaccharide. The drug inhibits arabinacyl transferase enzyme. Thus, functional mycobacterial cell wall is inhibited. Resistance, the mechanism is really not clearly understood. We know that when the drug is used alone, resistance emerges very rapidly. The precise mechanism for the resistance to ethambutol is not known. Clinically, or its clinical profile, is again summarized here. The drug is well absorbed orally. The drug distributes extensively throughout the body, into tissues, intracellularly, into lung, localizes in lung, the site certainly of one form of tuberculosis, also gets into the brain, as all of these do. And the drug is metabolized to a small extent And the metabolism involves oxidation of those alcohols. If you say, is that important? I will tell you, no, it's not. But the drug undergoes some metabolism to a small extent. The parent and the metabolites are excreted by the kidneys. Well, what are the issues, the concerns with the use of ethambutol? This is a very well-tolerated drug, and here's the one area of concern. And that is, the drug has the potential to produce an optic neuritis. It affects both the visual acuity of the patient, and it results in loss of ability to discriminate between red and green. The optic neuritis is dose dependent. The optic neuritis is reversible. It occurs in less than 1% of patients treated with this drug in multiple drug protocols. This is the most frequently encountered, other than the routine stuff, and the unique side effect associated with ethambutol. Now, we've talked about four drugs. The question is, here's the question. How are we going to treat Connie Kuhl? Okay? Now remember, this happened in Bloomington, Indiana, not Brooklyn, New York. Okay? So if we know the history of Mycobacterium tuberculosis and we know that cases here in Indiana, we've almost never seen multiple drug-resistant cases of tuberculosis. There's no reason initially to suspect that Connie has multiple drug-resistant organism. The typical protocol that one might, there are multiple, might choose for the treatment of Connie Kuhl would be three drugs to diminish the emergence of resistance, to increase the kill rate, isoniazid, rifampin, pyrazinamide. I said pyrazinamide is only good for 2 months. So after 2 months, the pyrazinamide would be dropped out because of its potential or the risk for potentially leading to hepatotoxicity. And isoniazid and rifampin would continue for maybe 6 months. Now, 10 years ago, tuberculosis treatment required anywhere from 9 months to 2 years. By using pyrazinamide, it was possible to shorten the duration of treatment. And that's a win-win for everybody, the healthcare system, the patient, and in terms of achieving cure management as well as compliance. Let's assume that Indiana, or let's assume we're in Brooklyn, New York. And in Brooklyn, New York, there are many reports of multiple drug-resistant tuberculosis. How would one treat a patient, or how might one treat a patient there? Well, one might treat a patient there by using all four drugs initially, and at least initiate therapy, and concurrently be looking at the susceptibility of that organism in that patient to each of these drugs. Now, this is a fairly torturous process because the bugs multiply very slowly. Doing drug sensitivity testing is a slow, arduous task. Therefore, getting that information may take a considerable period of time. So treatment is initiated, and then depending on the results, the drug that's inactive is dropped out, it may or may not lead to the introduction of an alternate drug. There are many places where multiple drug-resistant tuberculosis exists that will immediately start with the four-drug protocol. That is the simple scenario for treatment. Now, depending if the patient is HIV positive or not HIV positive, that's beyond, I think, what we need to worry about. I alluded to the fact that in many parts of the world, this is sort of on the house, okay? Many parts of the world, particularly sub-Saharan Africa and Kenya, where Indiana University School of Medicine has a program, and part of that program is treating HIV patients. And in Kenya, treating HIV patients, 80 to 90% are co-infected with tuberculosis. And so rifampin becomes a bit of a conundrum, and how you treat becomes also a bit of a challenge. Here's how currently in Kenya, IU, which is Ampath, IU would treat a patient that was co-infected. So the patient comes to the clinic, the patient has a CD4 count of 150, co-infected with tuberculosis. What they would most likely do initially is begin to treat the tuberculosis before they began to treat the HIV. So they would begin for 2 months to treat the tuberculosis. Isoniazid, rifampin, pyrazinamide, ethambutol, drugs we just talked about. This gets dropped out after 2 months. This gets dropped out after 2 months because of its liver enzyme-inducing properties that speed up, accelerate the metabolism of antiretrovirals. And so after 2 months, the patient continues on isoniazid and ethambutol for some period of time and antiretroviral therapy is initiated. I alluded to the fact of supervised oversight of taking of drugs. It's called directly observed therapy, or DOT. And the data is overwhelmingly positive that if healthcare workers daily oversee, supervise, directly observe the patient swallowing Z pills, one can increase the efficacy of the treatment and dramatically decrease the degree or extent of resistant Mycobacterium tuberculosis in a community, in an area, in a country, in a state. This has been done in New York. It's been done various places. And guess what? HIV is starting to co-opt some of these practices. Finally, let me just give you two other nuggets, and that is, what are we going to do about Mr. Cool? In other words, let's just assume that Mr. Cool, living with Mrs. Cool, and Mrs. Cool's coughing up sputum, and she has active tuberculosis, and Mr. Cool was exposed. How are we going to manage Mr. Cool? Well, what we're initially going to do, or what will be initially done, is to monitor him with a skin test. Mr. Cool is 30 years old. I just want to give you that fact. We're going to monitor him with a skin test, and that skin test can convert or become positive at any point in time, indicating that Mr. Cool is now infected. Mr. Cool has mounted an immune response. Mr. Cool has T cells, and therefore Mr. Cool most likely has latent tuberculosis. If indeed Mr. Cool's skin test after a year went from negative to positive, he would be a candidate, not necessarily would, but would be a candidate for treatment of the latent infection. And treatment of latent tuberculosis typically involves use of isoniazid once a day for 6 months or thereabouts. And if isoniazid cannot be tolerated in or by the patient, rifampin becomes an alternative drug. There are many guidelines, procedures, and some wiggle space as to do you treat, do you not treat. The risk of hepatotoxicity from this drug goes up with age. So Mr. Cool, being 30, is a good candidate for treatment. Talbozine, being 40, is not. Okay? You sort of get the picture. I have alluded to, and this is the last one, and then we'll look at some review questions, the fact that fluoroquinolones have activity against Mycobacterium tuberculosis. And it's not just one, there are several. But Bayer, the German pharmaceutical company, has one of these drugs called moxifloxacin, one of these third generation drugs. And this drug has now been shown to be quite effective in protocols for the treatment of, in multiple drug protocols for the treatment of Mycobacterium tuberculosis. And Bayer is saying, if indeed it proves out clinically, we will make it available at cost, which may be more than any country can afford, to treat tuberculosis. And the interesting thing somewhere in here talks about the fact that this fluoroquinolone can even shorten further the duration of therapy from 6 months to 4 months. The point is, there's still need for new drugs, and the reality is there has not been a new antimicrobacterial drug introduced and approved for probably 45 years. And the reason is, we don't have the problem. If you're saying, that's not totally true. We don't have the problem. In the United States, there are about 16, 17,000 new cases of tuberculosis every year. Of that 16, 17,000, a significant number are due to immigrants that have immigrated to the United States from areas that have endemic tuberculosis. Not all. The others happen to be in prisons, in homeless shelters, among drug abusers, where the organism can readily transmit, although it is not a highly contagious bug. Amen. Okay, now, if you would take, and I hope this is going to be helpful to you, if you take that review questions, there's a set of review questions and there's a set of answers, and then there's another set of review questions, and that's what we're going to look at the very last page, without answers, okay? Because you're going to help me answer them. And the question has been asked, what does the exam look like? And I'm going to tell you, it looks like this, okay? So let's just talk through these, and if you don't understand them, make me explain it, okay? Which of the following antibiotics is correctly matched with an appropriate clinical indication? Not the first, not the foremost, but is this appropriate for this antibiotic, okay? So let's just take it. Take penicillin G, otitis media caused by Haemophilus influenza. Yay or nay? Ouch. Superman, did you blow it? Okay, okay. Ah, you win some, you lose some. Okay. Carbenicillin, treatment of syphilis caused by Treponema pallidum. Let's just hold off the vote, okay? Because I don't want to embarrass you, and I don't want to cry in front of you, okay? Let's take a different strategy. Rather than saying yay or nay, let's see if we can find the fish in the pond, okay, that's correct. Rainbow trout. Okay, amoxicillin. Pneumonia caused by Mycoplasma pneumoniae. Mycoplasma don't have cell walls. Judas. Gentamicin. Okay. Meningitis caused by strep pneumoniae. What do you know about gentamicin? You don't know anything about gentamicin. What have you been beautifully taught about gentamicin? That it's an aminoglycoside, it works against gram-negative aerobes. Okay? Okay? It's a no. Hey, you got it. Okay? So that leaves us with chloramphenicol, lipid-soluble drug, bacterial meningitis in the brain caused by Haemophilus. Okay, let's go to number 22 to see if we do better than 1 out of 86. Which of the following antibiotics is correctly matched with a common adverse reaction caused by the drug? Clindamycin, hepatotoxicity. What is the most common side effect with clindamycin? Diarrhea. Tetracycline, cholestatic jaundice. Some say yes, some say no, some don't know. Erythromycin, pseudomembranous colitis. Okay. Metronidazole, anaphylactic shock. Finally, ampicillin, maculopapular skin rashes. Got it. Ampicillin causes maculopapular skin rashes. So if you can't get it by saying no, 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 one strategy would be to see if you can find the yes out of the five. Okay. 23. Which of the following statements correctly matches a drug with one of its effects? Okay, so now we're talking here. Could be resistance. It could be mechanism of action. Metronidazole, active against strep pneumoniae. Amoxicillin plus clavulinic acid extends amoxicillin spectrum to Pseudomonas. It makes it orally active, but it's not, amoxicillin has no activity against, yeah, that's okay. No, amoxicillin extends, but it doesn't extend to Pseudomonas. You have the anti-pseudomonals, and we simply use piperacillin as the example. Cipril inhibits bacterial DNA polymerase. Whew. Hallelujah. Okay, trimethoprim. Resistance results from increased bacterial paraminobenzoic acid synthesis. No. Well, cephalexin. This has got to be the right one then. Contraindicated in a patient who experienced an immediate allergic reaction to the intramuscular injection of penicillin G. Okay. Is this helpful? Or is this hurtful? Don't want to hurt you on Halloween, okay? Is this stressful? Or is this a piece of... You know, I should turn this off.